Oh, I had a good tagline. Oh, shoot. What was it? I was like, welcome to first reading. And then I had a good tagline. Nope, it's gone. All right, I'll think of it and text you at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Okay.
Welcome to First Reading, the Old Testament lectionary podcast for everyone who loves the Bible. I'm Reverend Dr. Rachel Wren, Assistant Professor of Biblical Studies at Trinity Lutheran Seminary at Capital University.
And I'm Reverend Dr. Tim McMinch, and I teach Hebrew Bible at Christian Theological Seminary in Indianapolis. And here the two of us are for an episode for Transfiguration Sunday.
Transfiguration.
Which falls
good
on...
Good word, isn't it?
Yeah. Falls on March 2nd this year, and since it's Transfiguration Sunday, the gospel reading is Luke's account of Jesus' transfiguration. That's in Luke 9. 28 to 36, and then they include the healing story after that, 37 to 43a.
Yeah, smattering.
But as far as our first reading goes, we've got Exodus 34, 29 to 35. Mm-hmm. Psalm option is Psalm 99, and the letter is 2 Corinthians 3, some excerpts from that. So how do we want to have some conversation about these texts?
Well, I don't know if this is the best way to do it, but I fell into a couple of Hebrew rabbit holes in Exodus 34, and then...
Those are the best kind of rabbit holes.
Linguistic ones. I went down the rabbit hole because I got really caught on this idea of Moses' face shining, which makes sense. I mean, yeah. You know, that's probably the most famous part of this story. It's picked up or at least kind of referred to in the Lucan narrative of Jesus as well. And of course, I'm big into body imagery. So Joel Lamont, who is, you know, both of our professor at Emory yeah. University, he does a lot with iconography of the ancient Near East. So different, you know, art and monuments and pictorial communications in the ancient Near East. And he would often talk, or I remember him often talking about solar imagery, this mm-hmm. idea, let the light of your face shine upon us, that the metaphor or the image is kind of picturing God as the sun. You know, you see that in Canaanite imagery, Egyptian imagery, you even see it in that seal from Hezekiah, like the one seal that we have from Hezekiah.
Yeah, solar light imagery
yeah,
too.
Right, right. So I think I kind of fell down that rabbit hole a little bit of just trying to figure out, what does it mean for skin to shine? And at least that's where I meant to go, but I got stuck on the word, shining. Did you fall down this rabbit hole as well, Tim?
The verb karam.
Yeah.
Is that, yeah.
Did you?
Yeah. There's some interesting history there. If I remember right, there is some imagery that comes from a translation of that as Karen versus Karan. And so some illustrations and some like picture Bibles have Moses with horns because the translation of Karen is horn, where the same root can also mean to shine.
So, yeah. And maybe most famously, Michelangelo's Moses. So Michelangelo did this huge, you can look it up, Google it, preachers, if you want to see it. He did this huge imposing statue of Moses. And he's got horns on his head like a demon. It just looks really, really bizarre. So I looked into Karan a little bit, and if I'm correct, it only occurs three times in the Hebrew Bible. Twice here in Exodus 34, both to reference to something that's happening with Moses' face. That's in the Kal for my Hebrew dorks out there. And then once in Psalm 69, and that's in the Hifil. And in that case, it does mean horns. So it's only three times, and in one time, it's very clearly not shining, it's actually horned. Friends, we cannot get through this conversation, at least I can't, without thinking of Moses's face as being horny, which is not like, it's not helpful at all, but it's just like playing on a track in my head. So I had to get it out there. So
I did not go there, but now that we have, I can't get away.
You're welcome. From it. Don't do it in a sermon, but apparently you can do that in a podcast, or at least I did. But so, yeah, so I was really just kind of stuck on this. Like, it's not the verb that we typically use to talk about God's face shining. So basically, this is just me saying I fell down that rabbit hole and I'm just kind of clawing my way back out. with nothing really to offer homiletically except Moses's horny face. So there you go.
Good grief.
Don't title this episode as that.
Too late. You know, it may be difficult to deal with homiletically, but exegetically, finding something that catches your attention like that and takes you down a rabbit hole is actually a pretty good thing to have happen, because what it's doing is it's drawing your attention to something strange, something weird in this. This story doesn't just play out like, you know, on Tuesday, Moses ate a cheese sandwich or whatever, and then his face was glowing. Like, that's what? His face was glowing?
Yeah, right.
When does that happen? How does that happen? What does that mean? And those types of questions draw you in and help you remember that, hey, there's an author behind here that wanted you to come across that sentence and go, wait, what?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Was there a sentence like that for you in this text, Tim, that you had that with?
Yes. So both the sense of the shining of the face, which was, it made me pause and wonder what is going on there. And then the like painstaking way that the author goes on this sidetrack about, well, Moses veiled his face so that it didn't get people sunburn or whatever. But when Moses went in to talk to God, he would take the veil off. And just like the practical sort of technical aspect of that made me pause for a moment and think about it. And that might be a place where we might find some preaching angles.
No, I definitely want to go there as well. Before we get to the shining, which would be another, you could call this the shining, that's less, you know, inappropriate, but more creepy, maybe. I want to talk a little bit about that word covenant that shows up, the two tablets of the covenant. So I looked at this in the Hebrew, expecting it to be, well, what word would you expect it to be, Tim?
Berit.
Yeah, berit, right. So if anybody's taken Hebrew, this is typically one that your professors make you memorize. This is not berit, though, which like startled me. This is a word that is edut. So let me back up a sec. When you're talking like the Abrahamic covenant, the Davidic covenant, those are words that are berit. This is the kind of the stereotypical word that we think of when we think of covenant, when we think of a promise. Edut is slightly different than that. It shows up a lot here in Exodus, and it shows up as well with David. When David is crowned king, he's presented an edut. And as far as I can understand, and correct me if you know something different here, Tim, but as far as I can understand, edut seems to mean more like a contract or a deed. It's like a legal document that makes the thing real, that makes the thing happen. So as I was picturing this, in a marriage ceremony, two people make a covenant together and their marriage certificate is the edut. It's the thing that makes the marriage real and happen. Is that how you understand this as well?
Yeah, and that works kind of etymologically too. The word edut comes from a root that means witness or bear witness.
Mm-hmm.
So a legal document that has witnesses that attest to it is an edut. Yeah. That's what an edut is. So it's a document that bears witness to a covenant.
Well, I wonder if there's something worthwhile in making a little bit of space there, because I've always heard like Ark of the Covenant, Davidic Covenant, Abrahamic Covenant, but it's not. It's the Ark of the Edut. It's the Ark of the Deed, Ark of the Contract, Ark of the Certificate. It's, you know, and it helps me understand like why that thing was so dang precious. We have a safe in our house in which we keep birth certificates, our marriage certificate, because like, those are the things that make it real. And obviously you can replace them, but it's a heck of a process to try to do it. Yeah. So like, you know, it just was so interesting to me. It helped me understood both the tablets of the covenant and the Ark of the Covenant better, because they, you know, that's the thing that carries the witness, like you said, the document, the thing that makes it real.
Yeah, the JPS translation makes a distinction between berit and edut. Yeah, so when it comes across edut, it uses pact. They use pact for edut rather than our covenant, which they would use for Berit.
Well, I like that even more because of the next time that Moses comes down with the tablets of the pact, if you will, he's holding the marriage certificate and the Israelites are engaging in idolatry. I mean, like, right? Like, oh, dang, that is, that is a slap in the face.
That's like the groom coming with the marriage certificate that he just got signed and the bride's making out with, like, the best man.
Oh, it's just like, it's kind of as bad as it gets. Well, okay, we've made a couple of interesting distinctions. Maybe we should offer some more sermon-y material here. Let's follow that shining image a little bit. I have a little bit of a side trail that I wanted to take, if that's okay with you, Tim, about why the shining face might have provoked fear.
Okay. Yeah. I hadn't thought about it that way. What do you mean?
Well, so I have this angle on Exodus and Leviticus that I take when I'm teaching my students to try to essentially try to help them understand holiness in the biblical text. In my mind, holiness is sort of the representation of raw divine power. So today we think of holiness as something that, like, makes you a really good person. You follow the rules. It's sort of like very tamed down holiness. But as I understand Exodus, Numbers, and Leviticus, it really was this sort of raw divine power. It helps if you think of it almost as like radioactivity. Like, it was something that was not meant to really touch intimately the human realm. It is so powerful. It's sort of like a nuclear reactor. And that's one of the reasons that Exodus and Leviticus put so many careful boundaries around what it means for the people to steward holiness, because they are being called to steward something dangerous, something wonderful, but something that if it interacts with human life in the wrong way, it will provoke this chemical reaction that is, you know, fatal for humans. When Moses comes down from the mountain and his face is shining, if we're doing shining and not horns, you know, then if we think of the divine presence as the cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night, the Israelites then know he's been touched by holiness. And that means that he's now somewhat dangerous to them, and they might even be dangerous to him. So that's one of the things that I stopped on there, was this question of why were they afraid? And I think they were afraid because they knew he had been infected, if you will, by the divine presence.
Yeah. So being around Moses would have been dangerous because to get close to Moses would have been to get close to God's glory, which was radioactive.
Right. And I think that explains one of the reasons why Moses would take off the veil when he went into the presence of God, because it was literally the only place where he could be safe. He could be unveiled and not be dangerous to anybody around him.
Yeah, that makes me think of a couple things. So one is that the use of that veil was actually like a helpful accommodation to the needs of the people. Like, they couldn't stand to be in Moses's presence because of the residual effects of his time with God. And so in order to be able to have community with him, they needed, you know, him to wear his sunglasses or whatever, so that they didn't get singed by God's glory that was on him. But I was also intrigued that when Moses went in to talk to God, he would take the veil off. And like, what's the veil going to do there? There's no use for it in God's presence. So I thought, you know, I was putting my analytical hat on a little bit to say, like, why is this here? What's this doing in the text?
Yeah, nice.
And I had a couple thoughts. One is that this whole little episode with Moses just underscores his authority as a prophet. Like, he didn't just disappear into the mountains and then come back and claim to have had some sort of divine encounter. Like, his very physical presence was evidence, bore witness, you might say, to the reality that he had encountered God, and that the words that he had to say were coming from the divine.
Yeah.
And so this physical manifestation was like a in a way like a prophetic sign of the authenticity of Moses's encounter. And of course, we're not there with them on the mountain. We're just getting this through text, through literature, right?
Yeah.
So it's a claim on the part of the author that Moses's words were authentically prophetic, that he was authentically speaking for God. And so, you know, take that for what it's worth. But the other point here that really intrigued me was there is, in a way, a kind of ideal of human-divine relationship here. Mm-hmm. That in Moses' interactions with the people, he had the veil on. But when he was in God's presence, he could just, like, be totally himself. Mm-hmm. No veil, nothing to, like, mediate this presence. But there was this direct personal encounter with God. And even though it was kind of special to Moses in this situation, it kind of stands out as an ideal of what human divine relationship could be. And that's where I might take this with a preaching angle on it. I think about the kinds of boundaries that we set in relationships with people, where we try to avoid TMI moments. And we kind of curate our public persona, the way that we present ourselves socially and in relationships. And that's not always done in a healthy way. But I don't know, having some filters, just like social intelligence and whatnot, like that can be a good thing. It can be helpful. It can be meaningful. Yeah. Just as Moses' veil was a helpful, meaningful accommodation to his place in his social milieu.
Yeah. Inauthenticity, bad. Social boundaries, good.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. But in God's presence, there's no need to have a filter.
Yeah. No.
There we have direct access to the holy that makes any veil meaningless.
Yeah, nice. Nice.
God knows us completely intimately, which, speaking of fear, is both a little scary, but also incredibly liberating. Mm-hmm. That there's no reason to pretend or to put on a persona in God's presence, because God already knows you completely inside and out.
Yeah.
And there's something there that I think in a sermon could lead to a sense of liberation in God's presence. Mm-hmm.
No, I think that's beautiful. I could imagine a really beautiful sermon on that too, and probably one that we don't talk about enough, at least in my tradition. What is the nature of our intimate relationship with God? I think that's lovely. You know, I was struck by the sort of chronological progression of the text. I followed this like face shining and veil thing through the text, and it was interesting to watch the back and forth between, okay, there's this problem, kind of like, you know, Moses is radioactive now. How do we deal with it? And I found it interesting that, so everybody's afraid in verse 30, right? In verse 31, they were afraid, but Moses called to them. And I find it interesting that Moses calling to them somehow calmed the leaders' fear enough that they were able to approach. I have a little bit of like images of Jesus speaking to the disciples after the resurrection. And it's in the speaking that, you know, they sort of recognize him or who are, feel comfortable coming around him. But I also just like this idea of a call in general, or speaking out to people in general, that it's the communication between each other in our relationship that is really the only solution when fear is one of the things that is driving us apart. But I like too that the text is not sort of glib about that. It's not just like he talked to them and then everything was cool. Like in verse 32, first Aaron and the leaders approach and they're spoken to, and then and only then all of the Israelites. And I like that too, because there's this idea that it's the leaders among us who can draw other people with us, that it's, you know, Moses speaks to the leaders and it's the leaders' call and their sort of embodied reaction to that call that calms the Israelites' fear. And here I'm kind of drawn into the power of life and death is in the tongue. You know, the Israelites were afraid. They thought they were going to die. And it wasn't through turning his staff into a serpent that Moses calmed their fear. It was simply through calling to them and through talking to them. And then I find this really interesting. And it's not until verse 33 that Moses puts on a veil. So he doesn't actually put on the veil, at least not at first, in reaction to fear. He names the fear. He addresses the fear. And then they sort of figure out, okay, we've got to live with this new reality. And how do we do that? Well, okay, let's put on a veil. But he doesn't react to their fear right away. First, he, you know, he says the words that need to be said. He draws them back into relationship. And then and only then does he put on the veil. So I don't know. I feel like there's a sermony nugget there. I'm not quite sure how to flesh that out, but
I think that's powerful. I hadn't noticed the sort of order of operations there before. That's really helpful that Moses invited the leaders first and then the people to come and to talk to him and to hear the commandments of God with unveiled face. Mm-hmm. And then he put the veil on. So I know there's maybe something there, not necessarily for a sermon, but for preachers to hear when you're doing your work of preaching, taking your own veils off and just being straightforward and totally yourself with your congregation in that preaching moment, bringing as much authenticity as you can to the preaching moment can have a powerful effect.
Amen. I think that absolutely.
So, I mean, the other tidbit here is the simple observation that when Moses went up the mountain, he was transfigured.
Yeah. Yes, he was.
And so maybe there's a connection there to the story in Luke about Jesus' transfiguration.
Yeah. So I got to to Jesus' transfiguration actually through 2 Corinthians 3.
Me too.
Did you? Okay.
Go for it.
So. Right. The reason I got it through 2 Corinthians 3 is because I think that there's a misunderstanding of this text. I'm currently teaching Intro to New Testament, and we're right in the midst of Pauline epistles, and we just did 2 Corinthians. So I've been thinking about Paul and about these conversations that he's in the midst of for a little bit now. And I just want to say, as you read 2 Corinthians 3, 12 through 4, 2, it's really important to be aware of the fact that Paul is doing something closer to midrash here. He's doing biblical interpretation that intentionally and self-consciously takes the text, in here the Old Testament text, a step farther than the text itself actually wanted to go. Mm-hmm. As we saw in the text, the Israelites weren't hardened and kept from something by the veil. Moses spoke before he put on the veil. They heard and approached Moses and through Moses God before they put on the veil. The veil was a boundary to allow their relationship to persist. So I'm not saying that Paul's wrong. I'm saying that Paul is intentionally reinterpreting the text in a way that if he was pushed, he'd probably say, yeah, I know it didn't go there, but that's not the point I'm trying to make. The point I'm trying to make is this. What Paul is trying to do, I think, is make an argument about the fact that the glory of the Lord itself has changed. The glory of the Lord has taken on new form and new flesh, which makes it something safe for us to access. It's no longer just the word that gives reassurance, as we see in Moses' story. It's the actual face of God in Jesus Christ. And that's how I got to the transfiguration story, because I think he's trying to make an argument that No. You've got a correct understanding of Kavod Adonai, but God is giving us the Kavod Adonai in a new way. Mm. The whole point of the transfiguration story is that through Jesus, God is now accessible to humanity in a way that he wasn't before. Here's my caveat, though, and here's my preaching pitfall. Do not get too excited, preachers. That's not the whole story. The good news of Jesus Christ was just that the glory of the Lord became flesh and dwelt among us, we could stop our yearly liturgical readings right at Christmas every year. But that is not the good news or the full good news of Jesus Christ. The disciples in this story in Luke 9, they realize that this is God. Jesus is God, or at least the Son of God. And they still abandoned him. Humanity recognized that God in Jesus was something new, was offering them something new access, and we still crucified him. The good news of Jesus Christ is that God became flesh and dwelt among us and offered us new life and died because of our inability to gaze upon the vulnerable and upside down glory that he offered us, and then that he rose from the dead anyway. And he keeps on offering that vulnerable and upside down glory to us, to all who call upon his name. it's a glory. I mean, this is where I go into preaching mode, forgive me, but it's a glory that serves, it's a glory that heals. It's a glory that restores and reconciles child to parent, like we see in the healing story at the end.
Yeah.
Glory that is now forever beyond the reach of death, and that is yours and mine forever. Amen. So that's where that's where I went with the transfiguration.
All right. I think we should all go with you there. That's a great way to read it. I had some of the same sort of filtering through 2 Corinthians into Luke's transfiguration story. Just to echo a couple things that you said, I find 2 Corinthians challenging, and this section of it particularly challenging, in part because Paul's not being super careful with his rhetoric that he's using here. And in the way that he frames what he says in this chapter, he's leaving himself open to being interpreted in a kind of anti-Jewish mm-hmm. way. And he has been interpreted through history in an anti-Jewish way. Mm-hmm. But the point that I would want to underscore here is that when Paul is talking about the glory associated with the first covenant that Moses was mediating, as he's referring back to Exodus 34 here, Paul's not making a contrast with like bad legalistic religion of the Old Testament and the loving, gracious religion that Jesus offers us. For Paul, the law that Moses mediated was good, and it was an expression of God's grace to Israel to show them their dependence on God. Mm-hmm. And in part, that's by showing them their inability to follow God's mm-hmm. commandments, right? That they have to rely on God's grace. But here in 2 Corinthians, Paul calls that gift of the law a kind of glory.
Yeah.
And I think that's important to remember so that we don't make a false kind of dichotomy between Jewish religion and Christian religion.
I think that's so important. And this takes all, I feel like all year with when I'm doing Paul, I'm doing this all year long, which is saying Paul was not involved in Jewish versus Christian debates. He was involved in inter-Jewish debates. This was, you know, Paul was a Jew through and through who believed in Jesus Christ. Like these were inter-Jewish debates that were happening in around him that he was entering into and taking a stance on.
Yeah, and that's always really important to remember. And because we're in a different moment from Paul, mm-hmm. it's important for us, even if Paul wasn't cautious in the kind of rhetoric that he used, for us, especially with the history of the ways that Christians have treated Jews over the centuries, it is important for us to be cautious and intentional in the way that we talk about these kinds of interfaith interactions around our scriptures.
Yes.
And, you know, the way that Paul interprets Jesus as a kind of new manifestation of God's glory in a way that is accessible to us, like you were saying, I think probably Jews and Christians today would mostly agree to disagree about that.
Oh,
but we can agree that God's covenant with ancient Israel was glorious, gracious, good covenant.
Yeah. And that it remains. It remains glorious, it remains good, and it remains relevant. God's, you know, covenant Amen. With Israel. I think that's the whole point of the book of Romans is Paul is saying, Gentile Christians, welcome, but stay in your lane. You know, the first lane is not null and void. It is still very relevant and very, very good.
Yeah. And to be completely transparent, I feel like this chapter in 2 Corinthians doesn't hit me the same way that Paul's argument in Romans does.
Yeah.
And in part, it's a different kind of genre, really. I mean, this whole section is, you called it Midrash, which it certainly is in the way that it plays with Exodus. But it's also just within the letter, a kind of, I don't know, rambling aside, a rambling tangential vent that he's been.
And that's one of the things that's tough about 2 Corinthians is a lot of scholars think that the whole book is different letters that were patched worked together. So we might have actually even lost the context for 2 Corinthians 3 to understand really what Paul was doing there.
Yeah, I would just encourage folks that if you really want to think through when Paul is not like
angry,
shooting from the hip, when he's reflective and thinking about what does it mean for Jesus to have come to Israel and what does that mean for Israel? I think Romans is a much more reflective theological perspective from Paul So, you know, for what it's worth.
Concur and hear, hear. Two Hebrew Bible scholars reflecting on Paul for y'all, preachers.
I had one more thought about Luke's transfiguration narrative. I think in the lectionary, if I remember right, it kind of alternates between Matthew's telling and mm-hmm. Luke's telling on alternating years. And there are a few differences in these two, even though they're almost verbally identical. There are a couple places where the authors diverge. And one of them is in Luke, when Jesus is transfigured and Moses and Elijah appear, we hear in Luke what they talk about. Whereas in Matthew, it just says, and he talked with Moses and Elijah. And then we like turn to the perspective of the disciples. In Luke, it says he talked with Moses and Elijah and they talked about his suffering that he was about to undergo in Jerusalem.
That.
Yeah. And it's interesting because it uses the Greek word exodon, Exodus. Yeah. So there's that connection to the Moses story. But in verse 31, suddenly they saw two men, Moses and Elijah, talking to him. They appeared in glory and they were speaking about his departure, his exodus, which he was about to fulfill in Jerusalem. And that little detail from Luke struck me, that in this moment of glorious transfiguration, what they talked about was his suffering. Mm. And to me, that helps because, you know, in the story that follows where Jesus heals the man's son of a demon, Jesus just has kind of like a chip on his shoulder.
Yeah.
He's got kind of an attitude, like he's coming off of a bad day, but he's coming off of the transfiguration. But if what he's just been discussing with these, spirits of the ancestors is the kind of suffering that a prophet has to undergo to fulfill the vocation that they've been called to, then Jesus coming in and saying, oh man, how much longer do I have to put up with you all?
Yeah.
Kind of rings true to me.
You know, and the other piece that in that, I preachers, forget everything we just said and just preach on the fact that Jesus is discussing his exodus. And then think about the Holy Passion Week and the cross as an exodus. Like, oh my gosh, that is just amazing. But the fact then that if you look at Luke 9, verse 35, then from the cloud came a voice that said, this is my son. In my head, I always finish that sentence with the beloved, in part because I'm thinking the baptism narrative. And many ancient authorities, ancient texts have beloved here, but the one we have is, this is my son, my chosen, which sounds really great. It's great to be chosen for a dodgeball team. It's not super great to be chosen to die on a cross. Like, this is a heavy, heavy day. And I'm so glad you brought our attention to those couple of details, because I think that can really make this story, which we hear every single year, pop for your listeners.
And when Jesus has had this, like, having to face the impending future, and it affects his mood, his attitude, even his words with his disciples being kind of short with them, and yet faced with a father who has a suffering son, what does Jesus do?
He heals.
Bring the boy to me.
He heals the boy.
He presses forward with the calling that God has given him, knowing where it's leading him. And that to me is pretty powerful. We experience sometimes, if we're lucky, just amazing times of worship and of kind of basking in God's presence, in the glow, the shining of God's glory. But if Luke is right, then true transfiguration orients us toward the vocation that God has given to us that may well involve suffering for or with the oppressed, with the marginalized in our communities.
But it also involves healing.
Yes, for sure. So if we're going to follow in Jesus's path as his followers, then just as much as we seek out and enjoy the profound experience of God's presence, it also needs to drive us into the I mean, the ministry that God's called us to, all of us, not just ministers, but all of us into the ministry of suffering with the suffering of the world for the sake of healing.
Oh, bring the boy to me. Gosh. All right. Well, preachers, just play Tim McNinch in your sanctuaries, and that's your transfiguration sermon. That's just gorgeous.
Well, I think we've probably covered more than enough random sermon outlines that people could use for about 50 different transfiguration sermons.
Are you all still there? Are you all still listening? It's just you and me now, Tim. It's just you and me.
That's right. Well, thank you, Rachel, for listening this week.
Thank you as well.
All right. Well, let's leave it there. For any of you who are still with us, thank you so much for being a part of our podcast. And remember that you can find anything that you need to know about us on our website, firstreadingpodcast.com. Take a look for us on Facebook if you're still around there. We're also now on YouTube every week, so we have videos of our lovely faces talking to each other. So if you're more of a watcher than a listener, take a look for us on YouTube if you're not already there watching us this very moment. But we're looking forward to being with you in the coming weeks. So until then, I'm Tim McNinch.
And I'm Rachel Wren. Happy shining. No, I'm kidding. Happy preaching. I didn't say the other one that I've been saying. So I feel like
I was waiting for it.
I feel like I should get bonus points. All right. Happy preaching. Bye.